All right, good evening. It's good to see everybody tonight. I'm glad to be able to share a message with you this evening. Before we do that, just a couple of quick things. Dwayne received a message from Jim and Pam Bosarge today and letting us know that Jim will be having surgery on Wednesday to have a device placed to help protect him from future strokes. So be sure and keep them in your prayers as they look at that happening this week. The other thing is, as Zach mentioned, the Millers that were here this afternoon are here this evening. Learned a lot about their work and encouraged by the things going on in Rwanda. In the West Lobby, they have several tables set up with some items that you can purchase to help support that work. I would encourage you to go by and take a look at that if you've not already, so that if there's a way that we can support them in addition to what we already do, that's available to you. Originally, tonight was supposed to be a marriage panel. And I spent some time talking to some folks about that and what we might like to do. And a lot of the folks I talked to weren't going to be here tonight. And as much of an expert as I consider myself on marriage, I thought that it... Why are you laughing, Kimberly? That's my wife's name. But as much as I consider myself an expert in that regard, I didn't think it'd be best for me to take that on by myself. So I look forward to doing something unique with that in future weeks. But tonight, you're just going to get to hear me talk for a little bit, and I hope that's okay with you. By the way, 52 weeks ago today, 1 year ago tomorrow, was our visit to River Chase, where we got to meet with the elders and talk about that position. And I threw my son in the middle of the aisle, in the middle of Dwayne's sermon, if you were here for that. And they still brought us on anyway, so we're glad to be here. Eventually, I'll stop telling you that we're grateful you've taken our family in, but for now, we still are grateful and glad to be here. My kids, think about my kids, they like to play games. We don't have a video game device in our household. I don't plan to get one anytime soon because right now, they like to make up games. They like to play hide and go seek. They like to play tag. We're now doing extreme hide and go seek, which just means they count to 30 instead of 10, which helps me out. Or I mean, ultimate hide and go seek. That's what it is. Extremes. I don't know what that's going to be. They'll figure that out one day. But they like to play. Now, they also like to play board games, which is my preference because they can hide in smaller spaces than I can. And at this point, they can outmaneuver me as they run through the house and we play tag. So if we can sit down together and play a board game, I'm all for that. We play Battleship, we play Connect Four, and I tell you what, nothing builds my ego more than beating my children in Connect Four. That's one game I can beat them in. Because see, for kids, when they play this game, what they're thinking about is they get fixated in their mind one specific place that they're going to be able to place the four pieces in a line and get it done fast. They don't think about what I may be doing. They don't think about trapping me in a situation. They get fixated on a pattern and they just go for it. But for me, if I play, or if we play against adults, maybe I'm thinking too much about Connect Four, I'm not sure. But we strategize a little bit, right? Or like tic-tac-toe, we strategize a little bit. We try to set traps or give ourselves multiple paths to victory. You know, for several weeks now, and months really, and for months into the future, and for as long as I can envision, we're going to be talking a lot about discipleship here. Loving God, loving others, making disciples. And tonight's going to be no exception to that. We're going to continue that conversation. And what I want us to think about tonight is that, and maybe I'm wrong, but I feel at times the way that we approach discipleship, that is creating, forming, molding, teaching, and a continuous growing followers of Jesus, I'm concerned that at times the way we approach discipleship is not unlike the way my children play Connect Four. We get fixated maybe on one model, on one strategy, in one context. We don't anticipate the barriers that we should. We don't want to consider having to play a more strategic, potentially long-lasting game. And so what I want to do with our time together tonight is consider the importance of connecting others with the light of Christ in four contexts that we may not consider as often as we do others. When talking about connecting others with Jesus, the context we often consider the most are at work, or at school, in our homes, among existing relationships that we have in our friends or even those here who meet together with us. These are important contexts that we need to consider, and they need to continue to be emphasized the way that they are, but we don't want to focus on these at the neglect of other opportunities. Strategic ones that might require time to develop, that may begin with minimal interaction and that are a bit of a less natural context even for sharing Jesus. Because the reality is that most of our relationships in this world, the encounters that we have, they're superficial. They're fleeting. They're a shared moment, and then the moment is gone. But as followers of Christ, we're called to embrace a different way. A way that is defined by a radical love for God and for others and for connecting others to God. And so basically, we're just going to look at four less often considered places where these connections can take place. And first of all, I want us to think about the importance of connecting in the marketplace. Now, some would take some different teaching points from this. They would say the marketplace is a place where people are gathered together every day doing lives together, and that's true. Some would say the marketplace is their place of work, and that can also be an accurate definition of it. But for us tonight, when I say marketplace, what I mean by that is it's wherever you find yourself as a customer or a consumer or a patron of a business or something like that. When I was 10 or 11 years old, my family, we went out, and my best friend Dylan was with us. We went out to eat at Polo's Mexican restaurant in Ada, Oklahoma. It shut down, and for good reason. But we had gone there. We'd gone there an evening to eat out. We go in, I'm 10 or 11, one of my best friends, Dylan's with me, and Dylan and I are just hanging out, talking, paying no attention really to how the food tastes or the service or anything like that. We're just having a good time. So we get up to leave from the meal, and we head to the car, and we get to the car, and as soon as we're getting ready to pull out of the parking lot, my dad says, "Oh no, I forgot my checkbook," because this is when you could write checks for food at a restaurant. But Dad said, "I forgot my checkbook, can you run back in and get it?" Which, you know, I thought was just, you know, Dad taking advantage of having a child and telling him to go do something he didn't want to do. And so I did, and Dylan went in with me. Dylan and I went into the restaurant. We go to the table we were sitting at. I see that the waitress is still there helping clean off the table. I say, "Hey, my dad left the checkbook. His checkbook, do you have it?" And so she walks to the back where they put it and brings it out to me, hands it to me, and says, "Oh, by the way, tell your dad thanks for the tip." I'm 10 or 11 years old, ignorant as can be, and I said, "Oh, you're welcome." Thinking my dad had just been generous or whatever. I get to the car, hand Dad's checkbook. I said, "Oh, by the way, she said thanks for the tip." And he goes, "No, she didn't." I said, "Yes, she did, but don't worry. I told her you're welcome." He said, "Josh, I didn't leave a tip." Apparently, he didn't find the service or the food to be the standard it needed to be. You know, you've probably seen this image or something like it. If you can't read it, it looks like there was somebody who had food and they were with a large group where gratuity automatically got charged. And so it was at 18%, and the person wrote, "I give God 10%, why do you get 18? And then gave nothing else as an additional tip. Maybe you've seen something like that. There's nothing that I can find that would say that was something that actually happened, that backs it up with evidence that say this was an event that actually happened. You can see the person signed it, pastor, whatever. That leads me to believe that it's somebody making up a story. At least I hope that's the case. Even so, I've had the chance to ask those that have worked in the food industry as waiters or waitresses, and depending on who you ask, they might say that Sundays are the worst day to be a server because they get the least amount of tips, or they might say it's the best day. There's no consistency, it seems to me. But my guess is that if you spent any time in any role in customer service as a waiter, as a waitress, as a cashier, as a manager, as a salesman, or whatever it may be, you've experienced some generous and kind, but you've also probably experienced some impatient or unappreciative or just at times just rude people. Now, I realize that Amazon and DoorDash and other delivery services and carside pickup at Walmart or wherever have limited the number of personal interactions that we have today in those places, but it hasn't outright eliminated them. And my challenge to you, to us, is to understand that in every one of those, if we claim to be a follower of Christ, we are identifying ourselves according to what Jesus said and parts of Scripture that you know well. In Matthew 5, beginning in verse 14, he says, "You're the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. And in the same way, let your light shine before others so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." Every interaction we have, whether it's just through a gracious smile, a kind word, or just showing patience and understanding, has the potential to mirror Christ's character. As customers, we have a unique opportunity to demonstrate love and respect to those serving us, creating an atmosphere in which Christ's presence can be palpable. A 2023 consumer study found that 74% of people are willing to abandon a line before it's their turn. 70% of them will do so after less than 15 minutes. What's interesting is that that line is virtual. In other words, if you're waiting in a queue online for tickets or whatever it may be, some 70% are willing to extend their waiting time to well beyond 15 minutes. It's interesting, in our daily rush through life, we will do just about anything to limit our interactions with other people. And as a natural introvert, I'm right there with everybody else. But because we have limited interactions with other people, we need to recognize the incredible, the valuable opportunities that are in front of us when we do interact with others. As cliche as it may sound, we should ask ourselves when we have the chance, how Christ would see and treat people he interacts with. How would he see a waiter or waitress regardless of whether or not they got their order right or wrong? What would determine how he values the pharmacist who tells you that your insurance has denied payment? Further, how would Jesus interact with the police officer who pulls you over for rolling through a stop sign? Looking at a crowd and a thought concerning worry, Jesus said to them, in context, it's talking worry, but listen to this. He says, "Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap. They don't gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them." And what does Jesus say about humanity? Are you much more valuable than them? Jesus looks at humanity and sees them being of the greatest, of the highest value. As the image bearers of God, they were and are worth the cost of his life. And if and when we consciously choose to see others through Jesus' eyes, we will recognize their inherent dignity and worth and treat them accordingly. When we interact with others, the waiter, the cashier, the barista, the bank teller, the car salesman, the insurance agent, the pharmacist, or whoever it is, it should be our desire, our hope, and our prayer in that moment to in some way connect them without exception to the light of Jesus Christ. Understand, every interaction that we have with others is a God-given opportunity to sow seeds of faith and hope. It's a moment to encourage a tired employee. It's an opportunity to be the exception among the long line of angry, impatient people. Do you have a moment to ask someone if you can pray for them? They may not have a moment to listen to you, but you have a moment to ask. Can you look someone in the eyes, say thank you, or God bless you, and mean it? Of course you do. The reality is that the opportunities to connect others with Christ are as many as you want them to be. So as often as you want to be the light of Christ, so as many opportunities you have to show them him. Paul said to the Colossians, Colossians 4, beginning in verse 5, he says, "Walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person." He says, make the best use of the time. Sometimes, more often than we might be comfortable with, making the best use of your time means staying in line, interacting with others, letting the light of Christ that is in you bear witness to the hope that we have in him. We want to connect with others in the marketplace as we discussed it now. Secondly, I want us to think about connecting in our neighborhoods. And to qualify this one, neighborhoods, one of my kids came home saying they learned that their neighbor is everybody, and that's right. But when I say neighborhoods for this time, I mean the place you live. There's a quote found in a Robert Frost poem that says, "Good fences make good neighbors or great neighbors." The poem titled "Mending Wall," in it, Frost, he describes or depicts a scene where two neighbors come together each spring to repair the fence. They replace the stones that have fallen and repair the fence. And the narrator is one of the neighbors, and he questions the necessity of the wall, suggesting that it's not needed between them. He doesn't have livestock that gets out. He doesn't have trees that fall on the other side of the property. Why do we need the fence, the neighbor says. To which the other one just kept saying, "Good fences make good neighbors." It's interesting, multiple sociological and psychological studies that have been conducted found that U.S. adults that regularly greet their neighbors, that is the people that live near them, generally show an increase in their psychological well-being over time. Think to yourself for a moment, how many of your neighbors can you call by their first name? I've got neighbors on every side of my house, and I can tell you the name of exactly one of them. Look, my dream home includes 50 acres. Half of it's wooded, half of it's not. It's got a pond. I can hunt, I can fish, and most importantly, I can't see my neighbor. But the reality is that for most of us here, we don't have that much distance between us and those who live near us. So we ask then, do the people that you are in closest proximity with, outside of your own family that you live with, do the people that you are in closest proximity with when the sun rises and sets know that you love Christ and want nothing more than for them to know him too? As Paul preaches to the religious unbelievers in Athens, he said to them in Acts 18, beginning in verse 24, he said, "Listen here. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being." Make no mistake, God has placed you where you are so that you can bring glory to him and others to know him. You know, we are so fortunate here at River Chase to be able to support mission points throughout the world. We heard of a good one earlier this evening. I hope you'll take time to look into the work at Rwanda there, as well as all of our other points. We'll send mission teams this summer to go to more than one place to support our mission points there. And those who don't go will watch and listen with interest when reports of those works are presented with pictures that are going to draw at our heartstrings and make us feel good about what we do, and we should. But there is no mission field, no mission point more accessible and unique to every one of us than where we live. Within our neighborhoods, there is a sense of belonging and community that should foster a trustworthy connecting point where relationships can be cultivated and the gospel and the light and the love of Christ can be shared. And you may say, "Well, I've tried to talk to my neighbors." Keep trying. "I've tried to tell them about Jesus." Keep telling them. "They dump strange things in my yard." Love them anyways. I've probably mentioned to several of you that there is a congregation in Memphis that I followed over the years when I was preaching full time every Sunday. You know, it's hard to preach and then also feel like you went to church sometimes. It's hard to do that. It's easy to be distracted in that role, especially in the churches that we've been at. There's 40 people, which means 10% of them sit right here, and I was related to them, and they're screaming at each other. So on Mondays, I made it a habit of finding a congregation who record their worship assembly and just tried to block everything out and be there in that moment. There's a congregation in Memphis then that I follow that I've watched often on Mondays. And several years ago, I don't know how many years ago, several, I think it's over 20 at this point, they recognized that the neighborhood around their church building had changed and it was continuing to do so. Many of their members who once lived in that neighborhood had moved to suburbs farther out, and those living around them were mostly of a different racial and socioeconomic demographic, as has happened in most large cities in the country, affluency moves out, right? And so recognizing that, the leaders, the elders, the ministers, and whoever, they devoted themselves to prayer, and they wanted to decide whether or not they needed to sell their building and relocate to an area farther out of the city where many of their members lived, or if they were going to stay put and pour more effort and resources into the neighborhood around them. After some time, they determined to stay put, and they shined, and to shine an even brighter light because they wanted to connect better with the community around them. Most importantly, they wanted to connect the community around them with Jesus. And for me, as an outsider looking in, of course, all I see is what they say on Sundays, and so they're going to paint it in the best light. But from an outsider looking in, it seems that both this congregation and the kingdom have grown in spirit and number because of that. In conversations like this, we often consider the instruction given to the apostles by Jesus in Acts 1 when he tells them that they'll receive power when the Holy Spirit's come upon them. He says to them, you'll be my witnesses in Jerusalem and all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. When I was at Freed Hardeman, I was a missions minor, which meant I took 3 or 4 classes that focused on missions. And every one of them at some point brought up this saying and had a map that showed, you know, Jerusalem was closest, Judea was next, and Samaria was the farthest away. And so the idea that was conveyed there is that there's an area that you're in now that needs to know Christ. There's a call to recognize and to take advantages of the opportunities in our immediate surroundings. Listen to me, God wouldn't bring you, he would not bring us to a place, to a home, to a house, to a job. He wouldn't bring us to a place where it is safe and it's okay to ignore the daily opportunities to grow his kingdom. To make, to teach, and to strengthen disciples. He would not put you somewhere where it was okay not to do that. But here's the thing. Most of us have dozens of personal interactions and impressions a day that aren't face-to-face. When we think about connecting with others and connecting them with the light of Christ, we need to think about what it means to connect with them in the digital world. In 2005, only 5% of Americans used at least one social media site. As of 2022, that number has jumped to 72% of Americans who use just at least one social media site, with 70% of them accessing it at least once a day. Related to this, as of 2021, around 85% of American adults reported owning a smartphone, meaning that in the palm of their hand is the ability to access thousands of people in less than a second. We know well the commissions of Christ. We know the Great Commission. We know what he says in Mark 16, 15, when he says, go into all the world, proclaim the gospel to the whole creation. And at no other time in human history has the followers of Christ had the ability to access the ears of the entire world and fill them with the gospel in the way we do today. This advancement of technology, it carries with it a number of risks and responsibilities. But as Christians, we should view it as carrying with it a heavy burden to use it to reach others with the light and the love and the gospel of Jesus. The reality is to me, and this should be that this idea should be among or even the primary use of social technology. The primary use of social technology should be to share Christ. We do well to remember the words of Jesus. He says in Luke 6 and verse 43, he says, no good tree bears bad fruit. And no bad tree bears what? Good fruit. For each tree is known by its fruit, for figs are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor are grapes picked from a bramble bush. But the good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil, for out of the abundance of his heart his mouth speaks. Technology, specifically social technology and social media, it has the potential to amplify both the good and the bad stored in our hearts. whether it's spreading words of encouragement, sharing valuable resources, engaging in meaningful dialogue. These interactions should reflect the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. But what does it say about our hearts when the majority of what we put out there, share online, or wherever it may be, when what we choose to amplify are words of bitterness, of anger, of pride, of complaining? What does it say about our heart when among the first things someone learns about us through our internet profile is that we're an Alabama fan, an Auburn fan, a Republican, a Democrat? You log on, that's the first thing they learn about you. What does it say? What does it say about our hearts when the messages we choose to share are discourses and arguments that have nothing to do with Christ? Look, it might be uncomfortable to admit, but it doesn't take very long to find out if somebody worships a god or an idol. I don't have to talk to you to figure out that in most cases. It doesn't take long to figure out if a person worships God or an idol by just looking at their digital profile. But there's something else I want us to consider here for just a minute before we wrap up. If we look at the first three pieces as I described, we see a space for natural connections, connections that already exist. It's natural for us to connect with those who we interact with in the marketplace. It's natural for us to connect with those in our neighborhood. And it's natural for us to connect with those in our online community. But what about the blind spots in our lives? What about when those relationships aren't there as naturally? How can we connect beyond the obvious community? Because whether it was eating with tax collectors and sinners, or if he was in Samaria, he was spending time with children instead of adults. He was hanging out with Zacchaeus. Jesus was often found in places where others didn't expect him to be. His choice to do so challenged the societal norms and religious experiences and emphasized, or religious expectations, and emphasized his mission to seek and save the lost and to demonstrate God's love and grace to all people wherever they may be. And as Christians, connecting with the less obvious communities in our lives is essential for embodying the love and compassion of Christ and fulfilling the Great Commission. To do so, we have to be willing to have an intentional presence in uncomfortable settings. We need to be willing to listen to the stories and the experiences and the needs of individuals from different backgrounds than our own. We need to understand perspectives. We need to understand their challenges, their goals, their dreams, their joys, their griefs. We need to do so without preconceived ideas or prejudices. It's in doing so we demonstrate respect and empathy, fostering trust and understanding, and of course, showing them the light of Jesus and hopefully calling them to it. You know, I recognize that most of what I've said, or all of what I've said, is just general concepts. Those of you that have been in my Bible classes know that I'd probably much rather ask questions and let you answer so that we can figure out what some of these non-obvious communities may be, or what our neighbors are like, or what it's like to be in the marketplace today. I'd love to sit down and have a conversation about that, but this isn't the context we can do that. So action, it takes specificity, it takes plans, it takes goals, it takes leadership, it takes feedback, it takes strategy. It's not just easily trying to place the connect four pieces in a row and be done with it. It takes lots of prayer. But I hope we can walk away from this with an understanding that the opportunities that we have to connect with others and connect them with Christ are beyond the obvious and the easy to us. And they should be. It should be that way. If for no other reason than we were beyond the obvious and the easiest connections for Jesus. He had to love beyond but the world said he should love. He had to connect with those who people didn't always have, weren't always okay with him connecting with. We fall into that. We're sinners. We fall, we fail. We're not an obvious person to be saved. Besides, it was obvious for Jesus to love us, to save us. We're recipients of that. So as you evaluate your life tonight, we may find an opportunity to recognize that you want to connect better with others. You want to be stronger in that regard, and you'd like for your church family to encourage you in that. Now's an opportunity to respond with that, or perhaps it's the case that you've not seen Christ as the Savior that you need him to see. Now's an opportunity to put him on in baptism and become a child of his. So anyway, our church family or our elders or anybody can be of support or help to you tonight. We invite you to let us know while together we stand and sing.